In the 1700s, people in London killed their pain with gin. London was one of the most crowded cities in the world. The stock market crash had left many people destitute. Prostitution and suicides were rampant, and so was drinking. Patrick Dillon chronicles the decline of a gin-soaked society in his book called Gin, The Much-Lamented Death of Madame Geneva. That was the affectionate nickname for the drink. Dillon says the wave of addiction to gin made for some gruesome tales.
There was a terrible story that hit the newspapers just before Prohibition came in about a poor woman called Judith Defoe.
Yeah.
She was a single mother. Her child was looked after at the workhouse, which was the social welfare of the time, if you like. And one day she turned up to work, having taken her child out for the day, and she told the people she was working with that she'd done something awful. Eventually she admitted that she'd left her child alone out in the fields at night. And a couple of the women who worked with her went out with her out into the fields to find it and found the child stripped naked and strangled. And it all came out at the trial afterwards that she had been drinking with a friend of hers and they'd run out of money, and so they'd murdered her child and taken its clothes and sold them to buy gin. And for reformers, I think that summed up an awful lot of what they were scared about with gin, that it wasn't just drinking that was the problem, but from gin flowed all the other social problems that they felt that were overcoming the city.
Now, you mentioned that there were ill effects in 18th century London, but this drink started out, I gather, with government support.
Well, the thing about gin is that the base spirit for it is made from corn, from barley and wheat. And, of course, at the time, agriculture was the biggest industry there was in England. And so the government in the 1690s saw that the best way that they could help farmers and landowners, and, of course, most of Parliament was landowners then, was to set up a new way of using corn. And distilling was a great way to use up extra corn and boost the farmers.
Incredible hypocrisy there.
Well, I guess you could call it hypocrisy, but I think we're talking about a government that wasn't used to dealing with social problems. That wasn't really what governments thought they were for. People saw gin not as being just like stronger beer. They saw it as something that was new and slightly magical and strange. People would say that beer drunkenness would make people cheerful, but gin drinking turned them into criminals.
Well, now, I'm looking at the index to the book. I was looking up something and just stumbled across this thing here. It says Gin Act of 1729, and then there are subheadings Failure of, Repeal of, then there's the Gin Act 1736, the Gin Act of 1743, the Gin Act of 1751. It goes on and on.
Well, there were a lot of false starts. And of course, for a long time, as I said, the government was promoting the gin distillery as much as they could because it was good for farmers. But gradually, as time went by, people started to see quite what was happening on the streets. And the statistics really are frightening. At the height of the gin craze in 1743, Londoners were getting through the equivalent of 2 pints of gin every week for every man, woman and child in the city. So it really was a frightening problem. But it took a long time to work out quite what to do about it.
So in spite of all the efforts to get rid of gin drinking, or to restrict it in some way, it's still around.
Well, that's right. There was a great set-piece debate at the end of Prohibition. And on one side you had the pragmatists who were saying gin may be wrong, it may lead to trouble, but we clearly have failed to control it. We've tried to prohibit it and it hasn't worked. People are still drinking it. And on the other side you had people speaking for principle and saying a government can't possibly condone something which causes such distress and misery, something which leads to crime and which breaks up families. And in the end, in 1743, when that debate took place, the pragmatists won. And they brought gin slowly back inside the law. And from that point onwards, the statistics for gin drinking are always going down. And slowly, by gradually raising the taxes on gin and the duties on producing it, they slowly brought it back under control.
When gin was finally legalized, did it get any better?
Well, I think maybe it did. Part of the process of legalizing it was that instead of being made by backstreet operators, the big companies moved in. So the kind of names you can see on some gin bottles now, like Gordon's, Booth's, Burnett's, all date back to the end of the gin craze. And that's when the bootleggers were swept away and industry moved in. And so really when they legalized it, they didn't manage to get rid of gin, but they made a kind of pact with the devil. And slowly it became respectable.
Patrick Dillon is the author of Gin, The Much-Lamented Death of Madame Geneva. He's in London. Mr. Dillon, thanks very much.
Thanks very much indeed.
And we're leaving you here with a song called All the Gin Is Gone by Jimmy Forrest. And for this evening, that's All Things Considered. Our show is edited by Martha Wexler, directed by Chad Campbell, and produced by Devar Ardalan with Susan Stone, Elaine Heinzman, Ellen Gutler, and Kara Gerhardt. Our technical director is Carlos Gomez, with audio engineers Jerry Tennant, Peter Alina, Mitch Eaton, and Sue Klein. Key Molesky is our reference librarian. The executive producer is Paul Brown. Senior producer of our show, Mr. Walter Ray Watson. From NPR News, that's All Things Considered. I'm Stephen Skeen.